Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us today is my good friend, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, here to talk about two thoughtful recent reports. One, co-authored with former acting Pentagon comptroller Elaine McCusker on the difficult task of nuclear modernization, and the other on the need to reform America's sprawling combatant commands. Mackenzie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I have to tell you that, and thank our sponsor, because I spent the morning at Bell's DC office this morning getting educated on next generation flight, and it was remarkable.
It certainly is a great center that they have there in order to try and help their story. And of course, we're very, very thankful for helping bring this to our audience on a daily basis. And I also want to say what a treat it is to talk to you, not just in our normal roundtable context, but actually to have a one-on-one, which is more than a little overdue. And I just want to also say that before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Let's start with the nuclear modernization question. During its tenure, the Obama administration concluded that pretty much not only every element of the triad, whether it was the B-61 weapon on the tactical side, whether it was the land-based Minuteman force, whether it was the sea-based submarine launch deterrent, all of them needed modernization. And then they concluded that not only did the systems themselves need modernization, but actually the entire sprawling infrastructure we have for nuclear weapons design, development, production, and maintenance were also thoroughly outmoded because they've been robbed for our investment since the 1980s. It wasn't just apocryphal that a current generation of engineers was hunting down folks in nursing homes to try to find some veterans who could answer some complicated nuclear engineering questions. Talk to us a little bit about the magnitude of the challenge the nation faces and the kind of decisions that may be necessary as a consequence. Because the Obama conclusion was, this is a trillion-dollar plus investment that'll have to be made.
That's right. And add to it that the schedule is pretty unyielding in terms of having to do it now and do it all at once, since they've, administrations of both parties have pushed this off as long as possible. So the head of Strategic Command said earlier this year that he's greatly concerned that we've all underestimated the risks associated with such a complex and time-constrained modernization effort. And that's like putting it mildly. But why is the Biden administration going to relook again the nuclear posture review as well as the need for the triad? Because the money, the sheer cost of this is totally overwhelming. And the department, if your budgets are flat or going down, then you have to find the money from elsewhere to do that. At the same time, you're trying to add money into other priorities for the long-term competition with China. Interestingly, that I think they'll come out similar to where the Obama team did? Yeah, I do, just because of what you've already highlighted. But what is interesting, it's not just that it's very, very expensive. People know that. What's interesting, though, is that the projected costs of modernization of the triad just since the Obama administration by the Congressional Budget Office have already risen $100 billion. So, that should just tell you that. And that's not the cost of it. That's just the cost growth of it. So, the cost over this decade is about $500 billion. And that's why everyone's panicking. They understand that there's just not enough money to do everything in terms of conventional and nuclear forces in the same decade, the terrible 20s, as Commander Salamander calls it.
But let's talk about that, right? Because there were people who were dyad supporters. I've spoken to people close to President-elect Biden who've worked with him. And they're sort of a mind that I think that going to a dyad might not be the smartest thing, that a triad is actually the right way to do it. And then there's discussion that we do have a very, very large nuclear arsenal. It's much, much larger than China's arsenal. Obviously, all of our strategic limitation agreements have been with the Russians that actually in some respects, that have an equally large arsenal, right? So ours is sort of more tailored toward Russia than it is to China, which has a couple of hundred weapons. At the end of the day, how do we we do this, right? The long range strike weapon has the LRSO has come under the long range nuclear cruise missile has become a little bit of a lightning rod. What are some of the trade-offs? Do we go with a smaller arsenal? Is the dyad really a relevant discussion to go with land-based ICBMs or sea-based ICBMs or sea-based ICBMs and land-based tactical airdropped weapons? I mean, what's the right way forward on this?
So the options, if you reaffirm the need for a triad, which, you know, it's possible that they could come to a different conclusion for sure, but most likely, right, we expect that they would. So the two most viable options are fewer of the ground-based missiles and or basically, and this is what I fully expect to happen in a Biden administration, you take out everything that the Trump administration added, because there is so much between the two reviews that they have in common. You know, Secretary Mattis at the time, when he was secretary, said, you know, this is the Obama review with some things added. So obviously the things added go away. And those are a lot of what you just talked about. So defense thinker Michelle Flournoy, you know, she's been out in the last year talking and writing and speaking. And she has actually said, you know, we do need to relook the cost of our deterrent. How do we do it for cheaper costs? That's the core question of the nuclear posture review. You know, creative approaches. Then she said she questions the need for a new nuclear warhead, you know, calling herself a skeptic on this need. So, I mean, these are just no-brainer, obvious pots that they will look to find savings.
And having that discussed that with Michelle as well, right? I mean, the challenge is how do you exactly do that? Because at the end of the day, all of our engineering and design skill is tied up in developing and engineering new weapons. And if you look at not just the Russians and the Chinese, but the French and the British are also developing a new generation of nuclear weapons, right? So, I mean, that would put us as an outlier, given that our last weapon was, what, in 1992, if I'm correct?
That's a great point. You know, we're going to leave one of our closest allies, the UK, kind of lost at sea on that. And we have to think deeply about the damage we could do to our allies' programs. I agree completely.
And of course, right, the B-61 has come under a lot of criticism because of the terrific cost growth that's experienced. But then again, those tactical nuclear weapons are what's forward positioned around the world so that our allies participate in the nuclear umbrella mission. And obviously, you can do a lot of nuclear diplomacy and messaging with it. At the end of the day, what's reasonable in terms of an outcome, right? I mean, Republicans still have the Senate. They've generally been supportive of the triad or are expected to remain control of the Senate. How do you think this breaks out, Mackenzie? I mean, how do we navigate this? We always have a tendency of making it sort of all work, right? I mean, so all the woe is right. Me's, you know, we tend to build nuclear submarines. We're going to build bombers, you know, but how do you see us actually doing this? Because, right, the infrastructure piece of it also requires massive amounts of investment, right? Every piece of it requires investment.
Oh, yes. That's right. Right. And that's why this has been a game of hot potato. You know, every administration's like, man, we got to get out of here before that big nuclear triad modernization bill comes due. And, you know, so, right. So you just scrape by year to year, hoping that, you know, the next one isn't the one where it lands in your lap. I look at the dollars, I would say there is a bipartisan consensus in the middle to moving forward with the plans of record. Chairman Smith is more of a skeptic than others, but not Chairman Inhofe on the Senate side. While I look at the dollars, you know, proponents of nuclear modernization, you know, talk about it in terms of percentage of the defense budget, that it's like a single digit percentage and therefore very affordable. And while I understand that, you know, again, my concern is, well, then you're taking money from other priorities. What are those? There's already calls to take money from other priorities for, you know, more spending on things like AI and 5G and all the rest of it. That's pretty bipartisan too. And at some point you run out of the money. But I agree with you. I think they're just going to muddle through until they don't.
Alas, I think that's sadly, Mackenzie, become a little bit of a national pastime for us. let me transfer over to combatant commands, something that you and I have talked a long time about. I know that you mentioned, you know, that, you know, that combatant commanders are almost like, you know, Roman proconsuls. That's certainly something which I think all of us have observed, right? I mean, when you go overseas and there's a conference and there are a lot of COCOMs, there are the four-star jet traffic jam that happens and massive staffs that oftentimes, you know, breed frustration even in the Pentagon, right? I mean, there's sort of the sense that each one of these, as you've said, you know, are mini Pentagons out there all around the world, and their influence certainly grew. They're warrior diplomats. In fact, their deputies more often than not are, you know, senior State Department folks that act as their second or their pro lads or diplomatic advisors. Let's take the first piece of this. Why, in your view, is this so problematic that it's something that needs to be tackled?
Recent Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said his number one priority during his tenure was to achieve irreversible implementation of the national defense strategy. So he was talking in terms of time, in terms of dollars, in terms of people in senior jobs and tasks of the department writ large around the world. And I think, you know, he probably moved the ball to the 50-yard line on that, which is pretty good given how short he was in the job, you know, a year and a half. Long for this administration, but short for a typical secretary. And so I'm, you know, looking at it through that lens, which I agree with. That's probably the right lens to focus the Department of Defense. Well, what I see is the department sending, you know, Navy flotillas down to Southern Command to do counter drug missions that are totally unnecessary. You know, torpedoes are not required, nor are P-8s for counter drug. We have a Coast Guard for a reason. We have constabulary forces for a reason. The department continues to have this mismatch between an overmatch, frankly, for the various churn and the global missions that are short of conflict, right? These are the global daily presence missions, the showing the flag everywhere around the world each day. And they don't slow down whether or not we're in peacetime or war. If we got 300,000 kids in Iraq and Afghanistan, the churn is churning for obviously. But now that, you know, we really have only a handful of people in harm's way right now, or you could go so far as like Captain Crozier to say we're not at war. And yet forces, the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force are as busy as they've ever been. And, it, you know, at some point you have to question what's all the busyness for and who's driving it and why is that? And does that need its own relook, the presence mission requirements?
So how do you go about doing it, right? I mean, so, you know, as you said, that demand is insatiable. We don't have enough ships, planes, and people to satisfy them all. Every COCOM, right? I mean, if everything's a priority, nothing's a priority. And each one of them have very long priority lists. I'm not trying to demean any COCOM, nor the challenges or headaches they have. I mean, in fact, I think that sometimes from a priority standpoint, if Phil Davidson said he needs a peer somewhere, we probably should give him that peer sooner than 2025 or however it's ended up. How do you control the demand part of this? How do you alleviate the stuff that you don't need to do anymore? For example, counter-narcotics missions or a whole bunch of other things so that you actually are out there and forward and doing the kinds of things you need to do to deter and to meaningfully shape, right? What's the process we need to use to get there?
Right. Or you're just harvesting readiness and you're giving your troops time for training and your ships and vehicles time for maintenance, right? It could just be that you're less forward to do other things with that time. It could be that you maintain, yeah, or you're forward differently, right? There are a couple of different options here to your point. But the first thing that's required is data. And the department hasn't sent over the reports that are required to Congress to look at these staff growths and, you know, other angles and elements of the combatant command explosion that I sort of reference in my article. So we need data, and then we need to know where the gaps in the data are to understand kind of how big is this problem and is it really a problem? And then secondly is to have leadership. It has to be an issue for leaders. And that's, you know, OSD, SecDef and Joint Staff. I don't know that they think this is an issue, right? They're so used to the just do something now. You know, they want to solve all the short-term problems without thinking, are we causing long-term harm in the five-year budget? You know, am I causing harm for another service by making this service do that mission over here? You know, I called it the global Jenga model where services put in and pull out and plug in for different missions all over the world, sometimes there are consequences to doing that that are not seen by the other service chiefs. So you need leadership to even sort of consider this as a question. You need a roles and missions review to get after it. And finally, you have to know, so where is the demand signal coming from, right? What makes these combatant commanders believe that they can we have a mindset and a mentality of zero risk for whatever problems they're trying to confront or deterrence or what, you know, whatever missions they're trying to achieve? Is that, are they linked to some O plan or campaign plan? And if so, do those need revision? And I'd argue, based on just looking around the world and the op tempo, yes, they do.
I think it would be fascinating the amount of savings you probably could derive if you just trim down staff functions, right? I mean, which grew like Topsy, perhaps to address past ills, whether it was, you know, Goldwater Nichols or, you know, the shortcomings of jointness. And as a consequence, right, have created a gigantic new class of much more expensive people than before. Right? I mean, these are colonels and commander 05, 06 officers, which tend to be somewhat more expensive than individual sailors. Bob Gates tried to get rid of Joint Forces Command, for example. Mackenzie, I recall at the time you and I actually discussed that. Jim Mattis was the Joint Forces Commander who suggested, hey, you know, we can pack this command up. All that happened was that the Joint Staff increased. You know, a third of those people ended up going on to the Joint Staff, right? So what are some lessons from the past that could be applicable to try to do this in a right way? I mean, at the end of the day, right, if you have the hands available, they do work. People get used to that work. So getting rid of that work becomes something harder to do. What are ways that we can think about this, given that, right, nobody is not doing anything? The question is whether what they're doing is important enough to be doing it, you know, maybe in the scale at which they're doing it. How to think about this
right,
when it comes to trimming.
And then as the 2018 Defense Commission found, the closure of Joint Forces Command then led to a similar brain drain in knowledge for joint concept development that the department is having to do right now. It's kind of like you're saying on the nuclear weapons engineering, like they gave away that capability. It left, you know, this orbit and nobody knew how to do the war fighting, the concept development, the training, et cetera, and all of the associated work. So it turned out to be quite harmful. Even if they all went to the Joint Staff, then they went and did something else, as you said. I really think a part of this is focused first on the regional combatant commands, because that's really, these are the leaders who are driving, you know, what is a explosive story at USNI News by Megan Eckstein about Navy carrier deployments, you know, and how they hit a record level in 2020. And what that's doing to the force. Well, that's driven by combatant commanders, right? And so when they're forward without port calls for 200 days on a regular basis, and they're doing another double pump, you know, not just the one we referenced 2 weeks ago on your Friday podcast, but multiple carriers are doing multiple double pump deployments as well. So, right. So shorter training time, shorter time with your family, shorter maintenance periods. And inevitably, you know, that you can keep going like that. And the, you know, there's no bright line, but and what do you eventually see? You start to see things like the 2017 ship collisions in the Pacific, where sailors didn't know how to drive ships. That's not the only cause, and I would never pretend to make it that simple. But you know, there are these second and third order consequences of this global demand signal being too high. But then we need honesty about risk. You know, CQ Brown, the Air Force chief, has been talking about that, and I'm totally with him. Again, so this really does get back to risk. And accepting more, or letting the commanders feel like they can accept more risk, because for whatever reason, they feel like they cannot. And I don't know why that is.
You know, one of the reasons we had, I think, so many carriers going out was, in fact, when Jim Mattis was at Central Command, his demand for constant carrier presence, or the constant presence of two carriers, burned carriers out faster. So we had to have longer shipyard availabilities, the refuelings, and you know what I mean? So all of this gets tied up. I mean, I think people have a tendency of forgetting that a nuclear reactor is not infinite power. It's an X amount of power and an X number of hours. And, you run it twice as hard as you plan to, it's going to burn out a little bit faster than you may have anticipated that. Certainly that's an issue for the Virginia force that was not designed to be refueled, and we are using them up at a faster rate. Let me ask you one thing. And that's just sort of a broader staff control issue. We do these exercises. I think this administration is coming in with a sense that some trade-offs will have to be met, right? Michelle Flournoy has talked repeatedly about we've got to start placing some big bets. You know, there's a friend of mine who made a roulette analogy. It's easy to win at roulette all the time when you bet on every single square. We can't afford to keep betting on every single square because that's a very expensive way of winning. What are some predicates on how to think about shrinking staffs, how to think about getting efficient in the right way? Because as you just mentioned, we sometimes do false economies. You know, we get rid of a command that we need for future warfighting concepts under the guise of getting rid of people, and then we don't have the people we needed at the time we need them, right? That argues maybe for having more people sitting around doing all sorts of things just in case we need them. But how do we need to think about the challenge of shrinking staffs, refocusing, given that you've worked on so many of these different efforts to try to improve focus and prioritization?
Well, I've talked about this before, and my colleague at AEI, former comptroller Elaine McCusker, she just wrote about it last week on Real Clear Defense. I think the most simplistic way to think about it, which is not easy, but it's simple, is what are the core defense functions that the department needs to fulfill on a daily basis to be ready to basically do violence in the name of the state if that's what's required to keep us safe? And then what are the core defense work that the department does every day? So, right, that's healthcare, that's grocery chains, commissaries, it's school for kids. I understand why these were all started in the first place, but do they need to remain under Pentagon control, you know, in the era of, you know, Amazon and other things that now, you know, commissaries are increasingly antiquated in the era of, you know, prime shipping. So I understand the difficulty in doing it. I understand the emotion. I'm going to get all the hate mail just from being on this podcast and even daring to suggest that we need to look at the non-core defense functions the department performs. But, you know, the Defense Business Board and other groups have been saying this for decades. And, you know, it's really only when I don't know what will actually bring success to or change to this conversation. It gets very political and emotional so quickly. It's just as if we're just stuck in the past and we can't do anything about it. So, you know, we're just going to keep on doing that. Well, that would free up a lot of defense dollars, theoretically, if you handed off some of that work to other U.S. federal agencies or to other outside organizations that are in some cases contracted. So, I mean, in my article, right, I said that the Air Force is using private contractors for tanker aerial refueling right now because they don't have enough tankers. So it's good enough for the Air Force to do it, but we can't do it when it comes to, you know, groceries. And I think that's kind of silly. I think we need to just have more honesty about these conversations and an ability to take out the emotion and talk about the facts.
I think one of the other things would be to reassess how we fundamentally use people, how we move them around, the kind of assignments they do, the kind of travel they do. I mean, you know, anybody who's been around the military for a while recognizes that there are a whole series of practices that are the things that the way things are done that maybe don't really make sense in a modern context. Mackenzie, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Always a treat and pleasure having you on, and look forward to having you back on again soon on the roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.